Welcome to the second Nest Egg podcast from 2X Wealth Group. This is Lisa James, and I am here with my partner, Lori Zager. We're a team at Ingalls & Snyder, LLC. The format of our podcast going forward will be a brief overview of what's happening in the market today and what we think about issues going forward, followed by a TLDR for those millennials who want to know just a short summary of our monthly topic. After the TLDR, we will have a deeper dive into our monthly topic, which this month will be restricted stock units.
So let's begin by talking about the current economic picture. Inflation surprised to the upside. The June Consumer Price Index, CPI, came in at 9.1%, which was the highest number in 40 years. The Federal Reserve raised short-term rates faster than previously expected and is committed to fighting inflation as their top priority. Two-year Treasury rates climbed from 2.29% to 2.93% from the beginning of the quarter to the end of the quarter, and stand at 2.98% as we record this. The yield on a two-year Treasury note was higher than the 10-year Treasury yield, which is often a negative sign for the economy. This is called an inverted yield curve. Most economists, however, say that the yield on the three-month Treasury bill, rather than the two-year Treasury note, needs to be higher than the 10-year Treasury yield for several months to truly make a recession call. Stay posted. The stock market experienced significant multiple compression, which means the amount people were willing to pay for the level of earnings was much less. The P/E ratio went from 20 to 16. Much of this can be attributed to the strong relationship between higher interest rates and lower price earnings or P/E multiples. We talk about this in our first podcast. Concerns about the Fed creating a recession also weighed on stocks. Commodity prices fell as people were worried that a recession would create less demand for energy and materials. Now let's take a look at how our canvas looks. Pundits have switched from saying inflation is transitory to saying inflation has peaked, and we really think they're missing the point. There's a bigger issue, and the fact is that the current inflation is sticky. It may not be 9.2% for the next consumer price index reading, but chances are it's going to remain elevated for some time and probably not likely to get back to the Fed's desired 2% type inflation reading for some time. So the question is why? The first thing we mentioned is deglobalization. As we're recording this podcast, Congress is considering a bill to bring some semiconductor manufacturing back to the United States. We wouldn't be surprised if drug manufacturing followed. And I heard the CEO of Whirlpool recently say that he was bringing back some manufacturing to the United States because he didn't want to have or not be able to have available critical components to his appliances. That's good news, and to some degree in terms of bringing jobs back to the U.S., but the bad news is that it's more expensive to manufacture in the U.S. than it is to manufacture where many of these things are currently manufactured, drugs in China, semiconductors in Taiwan, et cetera. The second reason that we think inflation is going to be sticky is the lack of supply. Energy and commodity prices have come down for now, but there are structural problems with supply. One way of looking at inflation is too little supply for any given amount of demand, or too much demand chasing too little supply. So the Federal Reserve has kind of crude tools to deal with inflation. They can try to lower demand by raising interest rates and hope that that lowering of demand will be enough to deal with whatever supply is there. But our feeling is that although there will be demand destruction, which is what the Fed is doing by raising interest rates, it won't be enough for certain types of supply. And energy is a big issue. And we think there are some shortages of other commodities as well. It's not going away anytime soon. And we really fear for what's going on in Europe this winter. I was recently in Germany, and they were talking about fining people if they didn't keep their thermostats at certain levels during the winter. And that was in the middle of summer. So I think it's going to be a problem. Another thing that we're concerned about is, in terms of sticky inflation, is labor shortages. We're not replacing ourselves in the developed world. I read recently that for every 11.5 million job openings in the U.S., we have just 6 million people that are unemployed. Janet Yellen referred to a similar statistic in a speech I heard her recently give. So that gives you an illustration of the fact that we are short workers in this country. Help wanted signs aren't going away anytime soon. And we're finding that companies are having to pay more for workers. So, and we don't think this is going to change. Yes, if the Fed creates enough demand destruction, you will get unemployment to rise, but we don't think unemployment levels will go anywhere near where they have in the past because of this, you know, lack of people. Supply chain issues, while some of those have improved, there's still problems. Additional COVID lockdowns in China continue to weigh on those. Those will probably get fixed at some point. And then it's kind of a technical thing, but it's the timing of shelter pricing in the CPI. The shelter index comprises about 33% of the consumer price index. And the two components of the shelter index are something called owner equivalent rent and the cost of renting a primary residence. And owner equivalent rent, just to define it, is the amount of rent that you would have to be paid in order to substitute a currently owned house as a rental property. The bottom line is that calculation is very slow moving. So even though you might start seeing some better housing or lower housing prices and lower rental numbers, it doesn't show up in the calculation for some time. So that's going to make the CPI calculation be a little higher than one would anticipate. And then we've talked about, in talking about the supply on our last podcast, we talked about the unintended consequence of ESG investing, which we applaud in terms of trying to help important issues like climate change. And we thought it was interesting to mention that the recent cover of The Economist has ESG on the cover, and it says three letters that won't save the planet. We thought that was apropos, given our comments about ESG and the problems that it inadvertently caused on supply of important commodities. And I guess, lastly, before we turn to the restricted stock units, we just want to say that we're not climate naysayers, and we do our best by installing solar panels and driving electric cars. And the extremely hot temperatures in Europe, melting ice caps, rising oceans, California wildfires, this should give everyone pause. We believe renewable energy will eventually dominate, but the transition will not be smooth as we continue to experience the push and pull of energy demand, dislike of fossil fuels, and insufficient ability of clean energy sources. I say it's kind of like dating. There is no perfect match. One must be willing to make some trade-offs. So we just want to address that issue because we've spoken so much about the problems. We want you to know that it's not because we don't believe that there is a climate crisis on Earth. So now for the too long didn't read. I hope my daughter is appreciating this because she's the millennial that requested it. So we're going to speak about restricted stock units. And for those of you that have restricted stock units, I would highly recommend that you listen to the detailed analysis of this. But just in summary, restricted stock units are a popular form of equity compensation. They're taxed as ordinary income when they vest. And if you choose to keep your RSUs once they vest, it's conceptually the same as getting a cash bonus and deciding to buy your company stock with the money. I can tell you that a lot of millennials thought they understood restricted stock units, but when the restricted stock units started going down because of the price of the stock was going down, they thought maybe they didn't understand them so well. So here we go. Now the presentation on restricted stock units.
Restricted stock units are used by companies in order to reward employees and to give them an incentive to remain part of the company. RSUs can provide a very significant financial benefit if the company performs well and the stock price goes up. In fact, it can become a significant percentage of income each year for employees who get stock units. It's important to understand how they work, how they are taxed, and also how to manage the risk of the stock that you might accumulate. How does an RSU work? An RSU actually grants the employee a specific number of shares of their company stock. And there are two key dates associated with these RSUs. The first is the grant date, which is when the company promises the restricted shares to you, but you actually don't own them yet. Then the second date that's very important is the vesting date. And this is when the shares are no longer restricted and you actually own them free and clear. RSUs typically vest after a certain number of years have passed while you're working for the company. And sometimes the company has to reach a milestone, like there's a product or service launch, or there's a sales or earning target that's met. And for private companies, that milestone might be a merger or an acquisition or an IPO. So once these RSUs vest, you own the shares and you can choose to hold them or sell them. And companies generally provide specific dates called trading windows, which specify when you can sell your vested shares.
And remember, once they vest, you pay taxes on them.
How are your RSUs taxed? Because they're considered compensation, you typically owe ordinary income tax on the value of your stock the day it vests. And you will owe this ordinary income tax whether you hold or sell your shares. And most companies will give you the option of selling some of your shares to cover your tax obligation on the day they vest. If you choose to keep your RSUs after they vest, any gain or loss on that value from the vesting date forward will be treated as a short or a long-term capital gain. This is identical to any other stock that you could purchase. One of the things we find people really get confused about is when they look at their statement, they see sometimes one number that combines the value of the stock that they own and can sell, also the value of the unvested stock that they don't own yet and can't sell. You know, it's sometimes hard to understand where your risk is. So your primary risk is what you own, because that's something you can do something about. But you also have some risk in terms of your unvested stock, because that's exposure you have to your company going forward. One of the important things about looking at vested and unvested RSUs is understanding how to manage your risk. You have direct risk to stock that you own that you could sell, and you can manage the risk by selling it. And you also have risk in the sense that if you have a lot of unvested RSUs, your overall equity exposure to your company and your company's industry may be quite big, and that might make you want to invest the rest of your equity money somewhat differently. So what are the things that go into deciding whether to sell your shares or not? This decision is very individual and depends on your financial situation. And there are a few key things people consider. One is the risk of having your job and your savings tied up in one company. I know several people who had most of their savings in their company, as well as their job, and their company went out of business. And that becomes a double whammy, because not only do you lose your income, you also lose a lot of the savings that you could have fallen back on to live on. There's a general value in investment diversification that lowers risk of loss in portfolios. So beyond the job savings combination with RSUs, there's just a general reason to diversify your investments, and that can lead you to gradually reducing your exposure by selling RSUs as they vest. You can also consider your own risk tolerance and the kind of role you have in your company. If you have a very senior role and you have a very high risk tolerance and you're on the younger side, people can be justified in rolling the dice a bit and just trying to make money off their company's stock. There are a lot of people that have gotten rich that way. So we don't necessarily say you have to sell your RSUs, but you really have to think about what kind of risk you want to take and what stage of your life you're in. So the bottom line is, If you get new RSUs every year you are employed and you get a significant amount of them, your exposure to your company stock can build very quickly. In fact, most people continuing to work for the same company create a plan to sell the RSUs as they vest in order to diversify their equity investments. Even if you regularly sell your RSUs, your unvested RSUs and new awards will continue to provide a lot of equity exposure to your company going forward. So this is not an either or situation. It's simply equity exposure management that we're talking about.
So there are a bunch of different ways you can think of, well, we think these are easy ways to think about your RSUs. If the stock price goes up between the grant date and the vest date, you're generally better off getting stock than if you got a cash bonus, depending on what I guess you did with that cash bonus. If the stock price goes down between the grant date and the vest date, a cash bonus would have been worth more. If you choose to keep your RSUs once they vest, it's conceptually the same, as I said before, as getting a cash bonus and deciding to buy your company stock with the money. We also, in our blog on RSUs, talk a little bit about how to read a statement. And you can call us or visit our website and look for the blog so you can see how to read your statement. We specifically talk about E-Trade and most of the companies that we deal with. There are a few that do Schwab, but it seems like E-Trade is really the primary person in that market. So there are a lot of people that have gotten very rich off of options in the old days, more of an issue than RSUs and restricted stock units. Think of the richest people in the world right now. Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Elon Musk. These are all people that did it with company stock. Having said that, there are also people that didn't work for those companies, including my partner, Lisa, who was smart enough to not have any Lehman stock when Lehman blew up. If you have any questions or more questions, feel free to get in touch with us at 2X Wealth Group. And you can reach either Lori at 2X Wealth Group or Lisa at 2xwealthgroup.ingles.net. And we have a website, 2xwealthgroup.ingles.net. Until next time.